privilege and a pleasure to get to come and share this adventure with you. So what I'm going to do is talk for a bit. If you have a pressing question, please do not hesitate. There will be some space at the end for whatever questions still are rolling around. And then post the end, there'll be some questions for you to consider. And certainly, as we talk about this, this is a very particular and specific pilgrimage. But the reality is that we're all on a pilgrimage, whether we leave Silverton or don't leave Silverton or wherever that takes us. So as I'm talking and sharing, think about the particular, but try to think about your pilgrimage and your journey as well, because I think they overlay pretty nicely. So this is my Camino de Santiago, everybody's Camino. Just like our faith journeys are particular and specific, mine specifically happened last year. I began on August 31st. I concluded on October 5th. I began in the midst of it. I decided that I wanted to make the journey to Santiago in 33 days. That's the way the one author writes his book, a day for each year of our Lord's life. And so the further I got, the more important those dates became for me. But my Camino actually goes way back before that. When I began interviewing to be a pastor here in Silverton, part of that interview process was a seven-year sabbatical. But in 2007, when I was interviewing, there was no idea when that sabbatical be, what it would be, or where it would be. And when I heard about this journey, I immediately knew that this was going to be the centerpiece of my sabbatical. It began in Saint-Jean, France. This is the old city. I'd just gotten off the bus. And that is my very first view of Saint-Jean. It ended 36 days later because I went to Santiago and then 3 days further to the end of the earth, Finisterre. For the ancients, as they saw the earth drop into the sea, they believed that was the end of the earth. 36 days, 896 kilometers. That is nearly 600 miles. To you and I. So I began here in the south of France. The first thing that we do, it's hard to tell, but you cross the Pyrenees and then made the way down and across to Santiago and then 3 more days out to the end of the earth. Now, in the Middle Ages, there were 3 great pilgrimages. There was the pilgrimage to Rome. Of course, that was where the Pope sat. There was the pilgrimage to Jerusalem, the death and resurrection place of our Lord, and this pilgrimage to Santiago. And what made this place important? St. James, the brother of our Lord, is who had taken the good news to Santiago. After he had brought the good news to Santiago, he had gone back to Jerusalem, had been killed. But his disciples managed to smuggle his body out of Jerusalem, and tradition has it that they smuggled it back to Spain. 1,000 years later, as the story would unfold, miraculous means, somebody discovers the remains, they decide it's St. James, and people start making the pilgrimage. Yeah. 1,000 years ago, there were no planes, trains, or automobiles, so the pilgrimage began as soon as you walked out your door. People made the pilgrimage for lots of reasons, oftentimes for forgiveness of sins, but also praying for health or wellness. But it was a profoundly hard journey. It was a brutal journey. It took pilgrims years and years to make the journey. Clearly, if we had no planes, trains, and automobiles, I would still be swimming. Now, one of the thoughts when we think about these pilgrimages is I think people tend to think of the Pacific Coast Trail or the Appalachian Trail. Do you have a tent? Do you have a whatever? As you notice, there are towns, and these are really just some of the larger towns. There are towns all along the way. The pilgrimage has been there for 1,000 years, which means along the way, all kinds of towns sprung up to help care for pilgrims. So some of them are huge towns that you might have heard of, like Lyon or Burgos. Many of them are wee little villages. But the reality is, I never camped out. The only time that people really did camp out is if there was no place to stay. I'll talk about that a little bit more along the way. But it is a well-traveled trail, 1,000 years, lots of resources along that path. So if you're going to go on a journey, one of the things that is absolutely necessary is to make some plans and to be ready to make that journey. As you prepare for the Camino, lots of books, and the books pretty much all tell you the same thing, and that is in your backpack not to carry more than 10% of your body weight. So you know when you envision people walking the Pacific Coast Trail, you know, with those great big beasts of backpacks, that's the last thing you want to do on this. My backpack is over here. It is actually like a day pack. It's 35 liters, which means you have to really pare down. Yeah, we're getting at what you think you need. Two pairs of socks, and I wore the same pants the entire time. And everything is very small, very compact. Now, very few people, even though they've read that rule, really buy into that because they say, yes, but I have to have all my camera equipment. Yes, but I may need to read my whole library, whatever it is. So very few people have little backpacks. You know, the backpacks just keep getting bigger and bigger and heavier and heavier. The reality is, it's one thing to walk 10 miles. It's one thing to walk 20 miles, but to walk 20 miles day after day after day takes its toll. And the more stuff that you're packing around with you, the heavier the toll is. So, when we began the journey, St. Jean is the most popular place these days to start the journey. And of course, when we all begin in St. John, oh yes, we're all going to go to all the way to the end of the earth. And oh yes, we're going to walk all the way, and we're not going to take taxis, and we're not going to take buses. And you know, we have all these big, beautiful ideas. And for the first few days, those ideas sound really good. And then those ideas start sounding crazier and crazier. It's one thing to talk about 500 miles. It's another thing to begin walking it. And then it starts really settling in how long 500 miles is. Now, I'm going to tell you, if you're called to do a journey like this, I think anybody could do it with two provisions. If you give yourself enough time, and if you listen to your bodies. But especially young people, you know, they're young and they're vital and walking is no big deal, and they're heavy backpacks. And what I noticed is it didn't take but about a week into it to watch every day people getting kicked off. And I don't mean that a bully was kicking them off. I mean that they were stress fractures or tendonitis or blisters so severe they couldn't go on or back. It could be a bazillion different things. But the weight of someone's backpack, what you're carrying around, makes a huge impact on how far you can go and what you can accomplish. So I've already told you that those little towns all along the way are to help support pilgrims. Pilgrims usually stay in a place called an albergue. Now, this is an ancient albergue. It was in the middle of nowhere. Especially ancient pilgrims, you know, that they would just build them because if you got caught in the middle of a storm, people make this journey year-round. You need things in the middle of nowhere, and it clearly is falling down. But when you think albergue, think a great big dorm. And then they take that great big dorm and they see how many bunk beds they can manage to get into that great big dorm. And that's how many people you sleep with every night. So sometimes they're littler rooms and there may only be 12 bunk beds. And sometimes they take churches and decommission the church and turn that into an albergue. Now, churches are made so that they have fine acoustics, are they not? Now, think about snoring with 400 people in an acoustical church. That was my experience in Pamplona. It was remarkable. It was incredible. But albergues, anywhere from maybe 6 euro to 12 euro for an albergue. And what that means is you get a bunk bed. I usually got assigned an upper bunk bed, which an upper bunk bed was kind of a pain, but it meant that they thought that I looked like I was fit and in shape and I could manage an upper bunk bed, which is, you know, I'm getting to the age that that's kind of good news. But where do you put your stuff? It's an interesting, I didn't have much stuff, but I did have a little stuff, and you learn to put it around the edge of your bed. But you got a bunk bed, and you got a place to shower, and you would wash out your clothes. Because remember, you really only got one set of clothes. You do have two sets of socks and underwear in case one is drying and you can wear the other. There's nothing complicated about this. It's profoundly simple. It's hard, but it's simple. You get up in the morning, and you pack all five things into your backpack, and you start walking. And at some point in the day, you find a tree, if you know what I mean. And at some point in the day, you find some food and another tree and maybe some more food. And by early afternoon, you need to start looking for a place to stay. The Camino has gained popularity again after many years of it becoming quieter and quieter with movies. I don't know how many of you have seen The Way. If you haven't, it's a fabulous movie. But the popularity has soared again. Historically, June, July, August were the big months, but everybody knows that. So May and September have become the big months. And when was I walking? September, which meant there was really a pinch on having enough places to stay. So if you didn't start looking for a place to stay by about mid-afternoon, that might mean that you need to go back 3 kilometers to the last town, or you might need to go forward 5 or 7 or 12 kilometers to the next town. Sometimes if the towns were big enough, they would have multiple albergues. Or if a town was really big, it might have a hotel. And worst case scenario, you could hire a taxi that could take you someplace, and then you could hire the taxi the next day to bring you back so that you could walk the entirety of the Camino. Over and over again, I experienced the grace of getting either the last bunk bed or the next to last bunk bed, which was beautiful and wonderful in my shoes. But then the next 30 or 40 people that came by looking for a bed did not receive that grace. So it was hard stuff. It became known as the race to the bed. Unfortunately, that there was that kind of stress, which also meant, remember, you're in a bunk room with maybe 86 of your closest friends or 400 of your closest friends, and it meant oftentimes people were getting up by about 4:30 in the morning to start moving along. And I don't know how many times people could zip and unzip their backpack or rattle things, but usually by about 6 o'clock the lights went on. Living in that kind of community is absolutely hard work. Nor on the Camino do you need a map. What you do is you follow arrows. Now, depending on what part of Spain you're in will depend on what arrows look like. Clearly, this is out in a very rural part. In cities, they often have something more stylized. It's kind of funny, this one with ziggity-zig in it was along this really long, straight stretch of road, so there was some zigs in there anyway. It was also very hard in town when they had them on the ground, because you're trying to decide, you know, where does that next spot go. I've decided that for the most part across Spain, the people that are putting the arrows out have about my attention span. Because just when I was quite certain I was lost, there would be another arrow reminding me that I was not lost. Only got lost once. It was the first day out of Santiago, the second day out of Santiago, so between Santiago and the end of the earth. And we were out in a rural area, and as we came to find out later, the route had been changed. A farmer didn't want 5,000 people going over his land, and it had been changed, and so there were signs knocked down. And I was traveling alone. About 10 of us were traveling alone. And it was like coming to the end of the alleyway when people start bumping into each other. And so these 10 people in their different languages and their different guidebooks are trying to decide what to do. It was a huge blessing to me because I wouldn't have made the decision they made. The decision they made was to go back about 3 kilometers. And when we went back about 3 kilometers, we found the sign that we couldn't see coming the way we were coming. But for the most part, they're exactly where you need them, when you need them. For me, the yellow arrow became a face of God. Seeing the yellow arrow, I was reminded I was not lost, I was not alone, and I was headed in the right direction. So even now, as I'm walking through Silverton, occasionally I'll come across a yellow. There's one just down our street. Yes, and I will see that, and my heart just kind of goes pitter-patter all over again. So, as I told you, Saint Jean, out of France has become the primary starting point for people who are going to walk the Camino de Santiago. And one of the reasons that it's become a primary starting point is that's a way up and over the Pyrenees. Pyrenees mountain range. Saint Jean is almost at sea level. And on this day that we go over the Pyrenees, it's 5,000 feet. It is initiation by fire. It's a hard day. It's a rough day. You're up in the middle of nowhere. It's very fun. The cows are in bells. The sheep are in bells, and I'd never seen this before. The horses were in bells. But maybe you don't find your horses unless they are in bells when you're in the Pyrenees. You can see an access road over here. We've got farmers up there and little ants. So, as I was asked about expectations, and I didn't have a whole bunch of expectations, but I had made some plans for myself. And my plans for myself were that I was not going to plan each day. People would say, well, how far are you going to walk each day? And it was like, I don't know. I'm going to see what my body tells me. And I did manage to do that, other than I decided at some point that I was going to finish in 33 days. I decided I didn't want to take a taxi, and I did not. But the other thing I told God, yes, snicker. Always snicker and tell God something. I am a woman clergy person on a Roman Catholic journey. Yeah, and I wasn't going to tell anybody that. I was going incognito. I was a peregrina, pilgrim. I wasn't telling anybody that. And when we first get started at anything, it's really hard to figure out how you negotiate things. So the first set of people I stayed with that first night, everybody's introducing themselves and what they do, and it comes to me, and I'm Leah, and I'm a pastor. And you know, they're with my best plans. What is really profound about that is one of the men that I began walking with, and I walked with him about 4 days, Ron from Rotterdam. And Ron was walking the Camino looking for God. Questioning his faith, questioning God, and God sends him me, sorry, Ron. But because I'd outed myself, God's plan, not mine, we had some really profound conversations. And it was a matter of just a couple of days that Ron says, you know, I see the face he didn't use face of God. He said, I see the hand of God everywhere now. And so God did that and did that quickly. This day was the first day we walked together up and over the Pyrenees. We are in the middle of nowhere, and I've just met this man, and, you know, interesting relationships, and we're walking along, and he goes, I think we should take the next exit and go find a coffee. Okay. I really didn't have any sense of his sense of humor at that point or anything, but at some point I figured it was a joke and we laughed. Not 10 minutes later, we come around a corner. We come around the corner of the mountain, and somebody has brought a big van up there, and they are selling fruit and vegetables and eggs and hot coffee. So we took the next exit, and we had a hot coffee here, and obviously that became one of his hand of God stories, that he could be asking for a cup of coffee, and it's almost as if though God pulled up the van, God's self, and provided it. A really important lesson, if one is going to walk 500 miles, is to be able to be present to where you are. Otherwise, when one is here, one can look out here and be very overwhelmed by what is still in front of you. The other thing about not being present is we tend to miss what's going on around us. Today, I ran into Salem for a pastoral meeting, and I had time, so I stopped at the Kaiser Station first and then jumped on the freeway to head down to my meeting. And I was a million miles away. I took the wrong exit. It took me 10 extra minutes to get there. But when we're not present, we really don't pay attention to what's going on around us. And for me, that was a huge piece of the Camino journey, was to be present. And in being present, noticing the butterflies, or noticing, it was hot those early days. There's no wonder the Spanish do siestas, and they take their siestas very seriously. Things really shut down from about 1 to 4. You don't get into anything. There's not food available. I mean, it's grocery stores are closed. It's hot. And of course, idiot pilgrims are out there walking. but for me, noticing a breeze, being thankful for the banana in my pocket, being thankful for the bush or the tree being there exactly when I needed it, being thankful for little bitty things. I was in town, and they were having a festival. And we'd spoken with an artist, and then the artist chased us down to give us, of course, recognize the arrow. It's just a piece of canvas with blue paint, and it was so precious to me. And I think things like this are so precious when you are present and can really notice very small things in a very different way. But to be on the Camino and to always be looking ahead is to not notice what God's got planned right here. The people, the conversation, a cup of cold water, whatever that might look like. But also, please notice all the old villages. We've got some ruins back here. Ermita, am I saying that correctly? A hermit. Church right here, and of course the village church. The path across Spain looks so different depending on what part of Spain you're in. Clearly this is a very wet part of Spain. I was only poured on twice in my 36-day journey, and both of the times I was doused. The one day I had come into a town, the forecast called 90% rain, and it sprinkled, but not bad. As I came into a town, I said, okay, if it's not raining, I'm going to go on the next 5 kilometers. And it started sprinkling, and I didn't listen, and I kept going. And by the time I got to the next town, it was just a joke. Every time I stepped, my boots were squishing out water. And then I'd say, okay, God, I get it. Could it rain any harder? And it would rain harder. And then I would laugh more. This is almost to the west coast, Galicia. Very, very wet, very, very beautiful. But the path here has been lovely developed. That's wonderful unless you're working on tendonitis. And if you're working on tendonitis, it's really nice to be on a natural path. Other times, the path you've seen along a field, in the mountain passes, could be brutal. Think about a mountain pass like a dry stream bed with great big boulders in it. And there were some of those that we came through as well. There are also parts of the path that are ancient. This was last year, 14, was the 800th anniversary of when St. Francis had walked the Camino. And there are portions of the Camino that really are ancient, that really do date back to those earliest pilgrims. And this is one of those ancient parts. It's hard to tell from the photo, but on the right, it's a rock wall. Thank you, that is just tough to say. But beautiful. And once again, this is one of those moments, the shade was such a huge blessing along here. One of the questions I'm often asked is, did I ever consider quitting? When I began in St. Jean, the hope, the dream was to make it all the way to the end of the earth, to Finisterre. And I was going to do it. And every day I walked, I became more and more tired. And every day I walked, I was watching people get kicked off. And a lot of the people, some of the people were older than I was, but quite honestly, a lot of the people that were getting injured and kicked off were young people, especially young men, 20-something, 30-something men. And I think it's because young men say, walking is easy, I can do 30, 40 kilometers a day with my great big manly backpack. And they were injuring their bodies. And so every day, once I was about a week, 2 weeks in, 3 weeks in, I was watching people trying to muddle through it, and they were in so much pain. Or they would take a taxi ahead for a day and think that if they rested a day or two, they would be able to get back on. And so what, again, that did for me was to cause me to be so incredibly grateful. It became clear that there was no guarantee, no matter how determined I was, there was no guarantee I was going to make it on my own to Santiago. And the more I watched people getting kicked off, the more clear it became that each day on there was a gift. And each day that I completed another 20, 25, 30 kilometers, whatever it was a gift. It was a gift. So, did I ever consider quitting? No. But there were days that I knew it could happen. But this is the first day out of Santiago. Isn't that beautiful? I had lunch in a cafe right back in here. It's a Roman bridge. You can tell the way it comes up in the middle that it's a Roman bridge. This day was miserable. And if I would have found a taxi this day, I would have been done. It is the first day out of Santiago. So I'd arrived in Santiago, and I toured the church, and I got my Compostela, and I got my St. Francis Compostela, and I had done all the Santiago things, and there was this big, huge celebration, and of course I went to Mass, and I don't know, for those of you who've seen the movie, the great big incense burner came, it was magnificent. Pardon me?
Terrible.
Thank you. Yes. It was wonderful. That was the best part of Mass, too, because it was all in Spanish, and you know, that was the high point. This is the day after. So it's like, okay, I've done it, and this day the signage was terrible, and I hurt, and I couldn't figure out why I was still walking. And like I said, if there would have been, if God would have provided a taxi right in front of me, I would have been in the taxi and out to the end of the earth. In hindsight, I'm really thankful that there was no taxi, but this would have been the taxi day. It's an ancient journey, and it takes you by so many incredible, beautiful places. This is a monastery. It is no longer clearly in use. It is no longer inhabited. And in fact, the Camino, the path goes through what would have been the monastery. Now, it goes past this little window, and the little windows where the monks would put offerings out for the pilgrims to help feed them along the way. The church is magnificent, beautiful. This is in Stella. That is the stairway to get up to the church. The hard part, the sad part about it for me was, is very rarely where the church is open. Oftentimes because I was there during the middle of the day, and so there were so many that I only got to enjoy from the outside. Actually, this one, there was somebody in there, an organist, practicing, and so I there was a door, and I cracked it open and looked, and as soon as he saw me, he came and made sure the door was closed. and even on a Sunday morning, and once again, I don't know that I was in towns in the right time, but even on a Sunday morning, it was really hard to find churches that were open. This church reminds me so much of our mission churches in the Southwest. But what I loved about this, do you notice the nests? Those are storks' nests. And they're left. They are often built on churches in this part of Spain, and they leave them there. Unfortunately, I never saw a stork. I kept my eyes open for storks, but I never saw a stork. The path goes all along Spain, and it was such an incredible journey for me. One-way journey, by the way. One time, one way. But this is people's lives, and this is people's country. And this is part of the journey, coming into Burgos, that the path is right along the Spanish military site. And so there are these signs that say, Spanish military personnel only, keep out, and the barbed wire to keep the pilgrims on one side and the soldiers on the other. Since I was walking in September, it was past the harvest, but through the fields, I never did see, I'm a farmer's wife, so kind of kept my eye out for machinery. I don't know if they do it all custom or what. I never saw the machinery, but we did come through the bread basket of Spain. These were actually really hard days being out in the middle of the fields because there were very few towns to break up the monotony of the day. And emotionally, one of the hardest days I had was a day, it was 17 kilometers with no towns in between. And it was a tough one. It was probably emotionally the toughest day. Now, who we did share the path with often, remember this is people's lives, this is where they live and they work, the cows. And it was very fun, you know, we're kind of country here. I certainly come from country, but watching the city folks with the cows, the cows just really freaked them out. But the girls walk the Camino every day because what they do is they take them out to pasture and then they bring them back in to milk them and then they take them back out to pasture. And so the girls walk the Camino and leave their gifts behind for the next travelers. I was in a high village one day for lunch, and different countries don't do food handling quite like we do food handling here in the United States. And I went in and got my sandwich and brought it back out to the front patio. And there was a chicken underneath me plucking in the dirt, and I was eating my sandwich, and along came a herd. Poverty in Spain is very, very high. And so the herds, this is actually a pretty good-sized herd. Herds sometimes were six or eight animals. And the same woman was taking them out to pasture and bringing them back in that would then go in and make your sandwich or whatever. Poverty is very high. But I'm sitting at the restaurant with the chicken plucking underneath me, and the cows come through. And the one cow got about this far away from me across the table. I was sure she was checking out my sandwich to make sure it was not her uncle. It was not. It was tuna. So we were all good. But it's such an incredible reminder. While this was such an incredible journey for me and so different from the rest of my life, for many folks, this is their everyday life. This is their normal. Oh, it's hard to see on there, isn't it? It's a rainbow. Can you see it, kind of, sort of?
Barely.
Yeah, it's really hard to tell. Yeah. It's very fun because...
Oh, I see it.
Do you see it? It's very... And actually, the way it comes across in the picture, if I dare touch this... Can you see it on here?
Oh.
It's much more vivid. Well, if you're going to get a rainbow, what does that mean? You're going to have to have
rain.
Exactly.
Somewhere.
Exactly. Well, sun too, but rain. Yeah. Along the path, I never had an ecstatic experience of God. I mean, there were never voices or angels per se, but what I experienced over and over and over again was God's faithfulness and God's provision. Getting a room when I needed a room, well, not a room, a bed. Getting a bed when I needed a bed. Having things that I could actually eat on a menu. A tree when I needed a tree. It was really big time if a bathroom had toilet paper and soap. That was, and if they had toilet paper and soap and paper towels, that was the trifecta. So, but again and again, what I experienced was a God who was faithful and a God who provided, provided abundantly, actually. Now, when you have very little to your name, and when you, when there is so little really standing between you and potential disaster, very little things become very large things. And this was a really, really hot. It was still early in the journey, and it was really hot. Along the way, I stayed in attics three different times, and this is one of the nights that I was staying in an attic. So went up about four flights, and then there were like four different rooms in the attic, and I was in the room that was in the room that was in the room, and my only window in that attic was like this, and it opened into the stairway. And so if I positioned myself just right, I might get a breeze from the stairway. It was so hot. And in the courtyard of the albergue was this foot bath. It was cool water. It was heaven. It was heaven. The closer you get to Santiago, the more markers and the more mileage. You don't see a whole bunch of mileage early on because there's really no point in knowing. It's still 475 kilometers to Santiago. But once you get to 100, it counts it down about every kilometer. But once I got to the 100-kilometer marker, that's when I really knew I was going to make it. Because I figured I could crawl 100 kilometers. That one I was going to do. Now, at the very highest point of the Camino is a cross and this rock pile that people are encouraged to bring a rock or an artifact. It's usually a rock from home. And leaving the rock is symbolizing leaving something behind, leaving your sins behind, whatever that may be. So I had found this little rock from the beach. I thought it'd be kind of cool bringing this beach rock from Oregon. And right before I left, my mom asked if she and Dad could find a rock for me. And I was a little nervous about how big that rock was going to be because everything needed to be small. But again, it's not showing very well. It's the little bitty rock on the rock. And it's kind of a heart-shaped rock. And my folks, brought me the rock and asked me if I would take that and leave that behind. And of course, it was a pleasure to do that. Before I left for the Camino, I was gone for 3 months. I was out of my regular life for 3 months. And my daughters began with me. We had some time together. And my spouse joined me at the end. But really, for 2 months, I was totally gone from the life we know. I was out of the country for almost that entire 3 months. And it was a week after I completed the Camino. I woke up that morning to my phone going off, call home, call home, call home. And in the time I'd been gone, I had not called home. we'd done some texting. And as it turns out, the phone call was because my father had died. Before I left, as I spent time with my folks and preparing to go, I'd asked them, what would you want from me? If somebody got sick, if somebody got hurt, if somebody up in the hospital, what would you want from me? I said, don't tell me now, just think about it. And my dad paused about 5 seconds, and my dad says, you don't stop for nothing. You don't come back for nothing. That's probably about how he said it, too. My dad died very unexpectedly. But a friend of mine has said, what a beautiful thing it is that in the year I did my Camino, my messy Camino, my dad did his great Camino in going home. There is my Compostela that says I actually walked it. Now, okay. In order to actually get a Compostela, one only has to walk 100 kilometers. So that means there's a little town called Sierra that many people start walking at. That's about 105 kilometers out. So that's a good staging point. But it's not just people coming, it's busloads of people coming. And the books warn you about this. And it's what they really warn you about is pridefulness. You know, that some people have been walking a long time and some people are going to walk a short time. And for me, it really wasn't a matter of pridefulness. For me, and everybody's Camino is their own Camino. Everybody's faith journey is their own faith journey. But for me, the Camino became a very solitary place. I told you I started walking with Ron, and about, it was the day after we came out of Pamplona. It's like, I just had to have more space. Mm-hmm. And all along, as I had planned for this, I kept saying it's about this relationship. And I packed my backpack, and I said it's about this relationship. And I'd repack my backpack, and I'd say it was about this relationship. And when I got there, God made it about this relationship. And I pushed people away. Yes, occasionally I would eat dinner with somebody, and yes, I would say buen camino as I met people, but for me it was a very solitary journey. I didn't want to confer, is it time for lunch? I didn't want to confer how far are we walking today. It was about listening, and there were hours that my brain was pretty quiet, which is pretty encouraging because my brain is never quiet. But for me, it was about the quiet, and it was about the apartness. To listen for God, to be with God, that very private Camino. So, 100 kilometers out, all of a sudden busloads of people are joining in the Camino. And they're happy people, you know, they're like we were a month before, they're happy, and they're clean, and they smell good. I remember walking behind this man one day, and he still had his creases in his pretty pants. I mean, and they're so happy to be there, and they're in groups, so they're just really chatty. And so it wasn't really prideful that I walked a long time and they walked a little time. For me, it was about wanting that quiet. And even in the midst of that, God created spaces that opened up and that I could get around and find my quiet, even in the midst of the newbies. So, as you look at the picture, tell me some things that you notice.
Dirt.
Yes. Small path.
Is it slanted?
It's slanted, it's going slanted. Uphill. Oh, yeah,
slanted
going uphill.
To one so side while you're going uphill.
On a sideways slanted path. Oh, yeah. How fun.
Someone walking. In fact, there's about four people along here. But what you notice is they're all
spread
out, and they're alone. The last thing I want to leave you with before you get to ask me questions is our journey, our pilgrimage, our faith journey is with community. There's more than one person on there, but it's still our own. There's that great saying that God doesn't have grandchildren. God wants a relationship with each of us, and that, the journey, it has to be our journey, and what will our journey look like, and what will we do with that journey? So, I almost kept to time. Do you have burning questions? Yes, ma'am.
You talked about the bus. So for people who couldn't walk all that way, did you see people getting on and just walking a little bit? And then...
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So there were all kinds of bus services, bus from town to town. And oftentimes, Briarly, if you're ever interested, first of all, I have books. If you want to take a book home, they are yours to keep. In my parish, we bought books so that people would know, and that's part of how we did the communication. So these are for you to take and keep if you'd like. These are not. This is the guidebook I had. This is mine, because what I learned to do was rip the pages out for the day so I could have pages in my pocket and refer to them. And a very dear friend had to know what I was up to, so she brought, so I had the whole book. But yes, it often encourages you to skip over the, because it's hard walking through the industrial areas of cities. So it often encourages you to skip over that. Taxi service is available all over the place. And there's even a taxi service, I think it's for €4 a day, that will take your backpack on ahead. Because remember, everybody's getting great big huge backpacks. So yes, there are all kinds of ways that to get from point A to point B. And I think I just want to keep being so clear about this. Everybody's Camino is their own Camino. So for me, yes, I walk the whole way. But God gave me the grace and the health to do that. You know, for some people it is. It's about walking a few miles and then taking a taxi or walking this portion. Now, another thing that happens a lot in Europe is especially people who live there will do a week, and then a week the next year, and a week the next year, and a week the next year. Well, that's their Camino. So please don't hear it. I'm not trying to sound like I'm in any way trying to take that away from them. But there's also something to be said for the effect of the Camino. Mm-hmm. And what they talk about is the first third of the Camino works your body, and the second third of the Camino works your mind, and the final third of the Camino works your spirit. And I think if you're doing a week here, a week there, a week here, a week there, you're never going to get that cumulative effect of what it means to do this day after day after day after day after day. But yes, there are alternatives.
Oh, I was going to say, so how hot was it when you said it was hot?
Hot.
Oh.
Hot. In the 90s.
The 90s.
I think that's 33. I don't was do it that conversion
humidity?
Well.
Humidity? What was the humidity like? Was it really humid too? Or was it dry heat?
It was hot. It was hot. Why? And I had a couple of days that I had what I called the miracle of the water, that I had water that lasted when it shouldn't have. A girl's best friend. So it was hot. It was hot. And you know what? The numbers really didn't matter. It was just about, here we are, and here we go, and kept at it. It was hot.
How did your feet hold out?
Not well.
Okay.
I had my boots. I'd had them. I walked in them. I have friends that would say that I walk all over the place. And I'd had the boots about 6 months. I had Keens, which means they have a big toe base, which Keens are wonderful. I highly recommend them. I did really well the first week, and after that, blister after blister after blister. Like I said, I was texting home, so my daughters were naming all my blisters. But I had darn tough socks. Those are one of the pairs of socks that I had. Notice no holes. Yay, REI. I used sock liners. I used Vaseline on my toes. I mean, there's all kinds of hints. My feet were just going to be miserable. And in fact, when I would get started in the morning, I have three daughters, and it reminded me of being in the car with the daughters, because I get started and my toes were complaining and yelling at each other, and I kind of like shut up and learn how to get along in there. The first couple kilometers every day were usually pretty miserable.
Were there a lot of trees or a few well used?
The traffic has picked up so much on the Camino that at first, you know, I would try to go out and around, and 3 miles later, and then there'd still be all kinds of toilet paper back there too. And Europeans do not have the sense of space and modesty that we have, you know. So there's 86 people in a room, and Europeans are changing their clothes right there. They're just going to the bathroom right there. The modesty is very different.
Well,
sense of space is very different.
So you said that you had food. Was there food at each town where you stopped? Did you have to put food, some food in your backpack?
So Briarly, that's why having a guidebook is important. Mm-hmm. We'll tell you today there's not going to be any place, you're not going to find anything today. So you need to have enough food and water to get to the next town. Or it would say there's going to be breakfast places all over the place or whatever. So I almost always had food. I always had my water. My routine at night was I would get into the albergue and take a shower as quickly as I could, wash my clothes, because the clothes you're washing clothes by hand almost always. That's why you smell so good. And then hanging them out to dry. And that's the blessing of walking during the hot season, because it usually dries. If it doesn't, I had a bobby or a safety pin that I could pin it onto the back of my backpack. But if it's raining out, that's not going to be terribly helpful. And then after I did that, I would go walk around the town and see whatever there was to see. Have food, go to the grocery store when it opened up again if I needed that. But I almost always had nuts, usually some bread, some cheese, maybe a piece of fruit.
Was the water drinkable? Is this my bottled water?
I did not buy bottled water. Spain is a developed country, so in the albergue, I usually just filled it up out of the bathroom sink. But along the way, there are all kinds of old wells and old fountains. But most of them have written on them, not potable. And I don't know if it's because of farming coming in. I don't know if it's because they're trying to save themselves from lawsuits. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just know that most of the ancient wells or the ancient fountains, they're there. But they almost all say not potable water. I didn't. That was probably what I was most worried about, because you know how fun is it to be sick when you're not home and you have to share a bathroom with 86 of your closest friends. So I because of some health stuff, I'm a vegetarian, and pescatarian is the proper term. And the thing said you really can't go through Spain as a vegetarian. It just doesn't work. And I didn't have any problem. I always had what I needed.
Nuts and cheese. Hey.
Yeah. And I didn't do any of that. Yeah. I was quite concerned about that. There were a couple of days that I started popping some Pepto-Bismol. But all's well that ends well.
So are there religious sites along the way?
Absolutely. All kinds of churches. And the book tells you what to look for and when to look for it. But the churches aren't always open, and sometimes open just during certain times. The church in Leon is amazing, the stained glass windows. The church in Burgos, also amazing, and little churches too. But little churches, sometimes it was just harder to get into. There was one church that we were in it was a wee little town, wee little village. And they went and found the woman who had the key. And the key, think of what you would think of as an ancient church key, and that's what she had. And she brought it, and we got to ring the bell. That was great fun. But it was knowing in those small towns who had a church key. And that would require being friendly and visiting with people, and that's not where I was. So sometimes I got invited along to things like that. But yes, absolutely. Ancient sites, I'd say, here was a leper colony, or here was an ancient hospital or whatever.
Any language issues?
I know very little Spanish. I know enough Spanish to sound like an idiot. And it got me through. Spain is one of the few European countries I've been in that people really don't speak English. But either other people intervening. And like I said, I know a little bit. I know enough to get myself stupid.
How did you ever learn to sleep?
It was rough. I don't sleep well anyway. And then the noise, even as tired as I was, I didn't. About the fifth night, we were in an albergue, and she was a stewardess, a flight attendant out of Samoa. She was Samoan. And she offered me drugs. And I hadn't slept for 4 nights. And she offered me drugs. As it turns out, the drugs were purchasable in pharmacies. It was a Spanish form of ibuprofen, which is a little bit stronger. And it knocked out all the leg cramps. It didn't knock me out, but it allowed me to sleep. And when my feet and my tendonitis were, it helped. It helped. All along the Camino are pharmacies. And in Europe, you don't normally go to a doctor for something small. You go to the pharmacist, and the pharmacist decides what you need and gives you that prescription or that whatever. And they're all along the way. And then also along the way, there will also be foot clinics, because it's a huge issue. It's a huge issue.
Anybody gets away without foot problems? I mean, I'm amazed.
I have heard people say that they didn't get blisters. Not me. I had blisters. And the blisters on the toes weren't bad, because there's these wonderful things called, toe wet. You just basically put it on the top of your toe. Toe caps. And that really kind of takes care of it. It was the ones on the heel. And then trying to get your heel in your boot. Oh, yeah, that one was rough. The toes, pretty easy. The heels were rough.
So you said you had tendonitis also?
I started in my here. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't going to go talk to anybody about it because I wasn't stopping. So I knew what the answer was. God is good. It started the day out of Samos, which was a wonderful, huge monastery. It was a side trip. Couldn't make up my mind if I wanted to take it. It was 6 extra kilometers. It finally occurred to me. At 896 kilometers with 6 more kilometers. So I went out to that, and it was coming back from that. It was beautiful, but it was largely on concrete, hard surface. And it was a Sunday, and that Sunday I was miserable. I was miserable, and I woke up Monday, and it was almost gone. And then about a week later, it was back with a vengeance. And then that was close enough to the end that I was just, grit my teeth and move on.
You put a lot of physical and psychological energy preparing for this. What would be one or two good things that you took away from the experience?
God is faithful. The other thing that was really important for me, and it was the entire point of sabbatical, I had people ask if I was doing sabbatical because I was ready to leave my job or I was burned out from my job. And for me, it was about rest. I did not have a to-do book along the path. I'm a planner, and I did not plan any sermons out there. I didn't plan any new church programs. I did not redecorate my house. I did not buy Christmas. I rested. And I understand it was physical. There's no doubt about that. But for me, it was a completely different energy. I really did. I mean, I left home. I left family. I left work for almost the equivalent of almost 3 months. So for me, God is good. God is gracious. God provides. And the rest. The opportunity, like I said, I kept saying it was about this relationship. And I don't really think I made that happen. I think God made that happen.
So you saw all different
Absolutely. A family pushing a baby. lots of retired folk. Lots of retired folk, because they've got time. They've got time. And I'm going to tell you, if you're called to do it, I think anybody can make this journey if they gave themselves enough time. While I was on the Camino, I didn't see the one of them, but there were two film crews. One film crew, I'm off then. A German comedian who did the Camino, and that film crew was out there filming. And then there was another film crew, and it was a documentary. And I think it is the story of the friend who pushes his friend in a wheelchair across the Camino. I never saw any of that. I heard about it, but I did not see any of that. But the man who pushed his friend in the wheelchair, it's my understanding they would come to a place where there was a huge climb, and there would be 11 people waiting there for them. Mm-hmm. to carry that wheelchair up the side of the hill. And the 11 people just kept switching out and switching out and switching out. So when you get the chance, if you see those stories, they're incredible stories of community. And like I said, that's not where I was. For me, that's the community wasn't about community like that. For me, the community was this relationship.
In the book written by a Jesuit priest, you probably have that there. I think it's in that book. Yes, I can let me know. I think it's in the book because I've seen read a couple different things. But about the retired doctor who was blind, and he walked with his hands on the shoulders of his wife. And that was the second time they had done it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
And it was like, yeah. Oh my gosh.
The stories are remarkable. God's faithfulness is remarkable. If you haven't read this one, I highly recommend it. It's wonderful. He's been a priest for 10 years, and this is his 10th anniversary, and he's walking the Camino to thank God. And he says a couple of really clever things. He says for his 20th anniversary, he's sending God a thank you card. And the other thing he says is, how do you get ready? And he goes, the only way you can get ready to walk this is if you pay somebody to beat your feet 2 hours a day with a meat cleaver.
And then you saw the movie, too, Walking the Camino, Five Ways.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was,
yeah.
Yeah. I would assume that within that community of pilgrims, even as a single woman, you would feel safe.
You have to buy everything. It is almost, okay, let's safety. Let's go safety, and then we'll talk. I have a really high threshold for feeling safe. I'm not easily shaken, and there was never a time that I did not feel safe. Never, never, never. However, there are all kinds of stories about, especially women being assaulted on the Camino. A woman being alone in an albergue or alone in a room. I think it often happens to younger women. I kind of move around like a bull in a china shop, so I think I kind of give off vibes like, don't bug me. At least I try. I was never an issue. It was never an issue. Money. Camino is almost entirely a cash-based culture. But there are pilgrims all the way. So there are ATMs everywhere, and they tell you where the ATMs are. Most every town has an ATM in it. Almost every town has an ATM. It's my understanding that Koreans have a habit of coming with a lot of cash, which makes them a target. Burgos, before I got there, about a week before I got there, somebody had gone through the albergue. Because, the one fancy thing I had was my smartphone. That was my method of talking to home. And people, parks, plug in their smartphones and go off and take a shower. And somebody had gone to the albergue at Burgos and stolen everything that was plugged in at that time. It's like any other culture. You got good folks, and you got bad folks, and you got thieves, and you got people that are going to take advantage. People are people, and behavior is behavior.
Did you wear a Morgan State shirt?
I did not. That is my sleep sack. I opted not for a sleeping bag. But yes, thank you, Oregon State. Yes, right there. This is what I opted for, and it served me well to the very end. And by the very end, if an albergue did not have a blanket, I had to find a different albergue.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah.